Welcome back to Integral Voices, convened and produced by the Center for Transformative Learning at Meridian University. I'm Bailey Murphy with Meridian University's Center for Transformative Learning, and I'm glad to be introducing today's conversation entitled Another World is Possible, Unlearning and the World We Create, featuring Hanno Burmester, Tomas Bjorkman, Monica Sharma, and Indra Adnan, and moderated by Aftab Omer. This conversation was recorded live with a virtual audience interacting with the speakers. Integral Voices is a video and audio podcast found on all podcast platforms, including Spotify and Apple Podcasts, as well as YouTube. To stay updated on upcoming episodes and to explore the archive, please visit meridianuniversity.edu/integralvoices. And now, on to our conversation on unlearning and the world we create.
And welcome, everyone. I'm especially happy to see some faces that I have not seen since the pandemic. So the occasion for this panel is a new book that is just about to be released by Perspectiva Press. And the author of the book is Hanno Burmester, who is with us today. And you will, if we are on spotlight already, then you will note that. Hanno there with the scarf. And the others in the panel, you likely already know or know of their work. And their authorship, their expertise. So our topic today is unlearning. And to approach that, I think of beginner's mind. I've had for several decades, since I was 20, on my desk or near my desk, a book called Zen Mind, Beginner's Mind. And in that book, there's a sentence which I'm glad to say I underlined when I was 20, and I'm still learning. And the sentence is simply, in the beginner's mind, there are many possibilities, but in the expert's, there are few. So this world that's possible that we want to create calls on us to be in beginner's mind. And we turn to you, Hanno, to start us off. One of the things I have enjoyed so much about your book is just how beginner's mind pervades the book itself, and the book embodies that. And so that calls me to call on you to speak to us about what are you unlearning at this time. You begin your book with telling us about a moment, a profound moment of unlearning when you were a child, and then same when you were in your 20s. And could we begin with what you're unlearning at this time, personally, professionally, whatever would be right for you?
Yeah, I'd like to share that. Thank you so much, Aftab, for the kind invitation and for having us here tonight or today in your time. I think what I'm unlearning right now, and not very successfully, is overestimating the importance of the mind compared to other more implicit forms of knowledge. like intuition or what my heart has to tell me or what my soul has to tell me. I noticed that this is something which is deeply ingrained, not only in me, but obviously in Western culture as a whole. And find it quite interesting. I don't want to, you know, do philosophical detours here, but I find it quite interesting how hard it can be to really use the entire spectrum we have available as human beings, and not just this upper 10th or 8th of my body. And I hope I'm progressing in my way of path of learning, but I'm not really sure I do.
So, Hanno, I will share also something I'm unlearning right now. Of course, as you know, when one is in the midst of unlearning, one doesn't necessarily know that's what's happening. So, right? Because unlearning is a real thing, and the disorientation is a real thing, and the identity diffusion is a real thing. So, a few weeks ago, I had a dream in which Peggy Rubin, who some of the people on the on this Zoom call, Monica knows Peggy Rubin, a very wise person, the only honorary doctorate Meridian University has given is to her. In the dream, she says to me, Aftab, your job is not to stand there with the finger, with your finger in the dike. And I found this immediately to be kind of a potent advice. She's a wisdom figure for me. She's the director of the Center for Sacred Theater. Her improvisations are wonderful. Her performances. So I've been just with the question how do I do that, and what is the unlearning there that will enable me to contribute beyond standing with my finger in the dike. So, want to invite. Whoever is ready amongst the other panelists, if you are so moved, to share where your unlearning is unfolding at this time. I'm thinking of you, Monica, with all your years at the UN, when you were based at the Secretariat, and you would go into the meditation room named after Dag Hammarskjöld. Surely there were unlearnings in that room.
Yeah. Okay, thank you, Aftab. And I'll connect what you're asking with what Hanno said. And I think two things struck me, but of course I'll begin with Dag Hammarskjöld, you know. One of the people I admire so much, and the recognition of the stillness that is required for what Hanno spoke, the unlearning. Unlearning requires me to quieten my chatter, my background conversations, and that room, which is called the room of quiet, with its symbols, is a space of quietening my chatter to allow my wisdom to unfold. And then Hanno spoke of the heart. So it's about my unlearning, right? So the first unlearning I have in my life, whether that was when I was studying in medical school, where I was at the bedside of the first woman who died while I was treating her and her circumstances. And then all I did was to weep in front of everyone. And they said, that's very not okay for a physician to do. I think that was a moment that the only entry is exactly what Hanno said. It's not the head, It's from the heart. And so the entry point of unlearning actually for me today and yesterday in the UN and a long time ago, 50 years ago, as a student, is from the same space, the heart. And when I say the heart, I don't mean, I'm okay with romance and heart, but I'm not talking about, you know, like the broken heart of my boyfriend's left me kind of place. I am talking about the universal heart of love. And that is exactly the space that awakens our universal values, so beautifully written in Hanno's book. And so for me, the crisis of ethical leadership and the questions of complexity, not retrofitting my ideology so that I have a beginner's mind, is what exactly Hanno's talking about. So Hanno, you know, in that diagram in your book, when you talk about all those things that we think about ourselves, the subconscious socialized spaces, and then you talk about the core self. So for me, the entry point of unlearning anything, and I can give you a lot of examples from my life, but I think I'd love to hear everybody else, is the pathway from the universal heart of love. The openness, I'm not so much about intuition in my life experience because I have to work, I work on the ground. And so it has been that space where time stops still and there's nothing you can do and you just unlearn what you learned, that you can actually save a life. Yeah. That one brings tears to my eyes. So if anyone wants to hear the story, I can tell you the story.
Please do, Monica.
Okay, this was a 22-year-old woman. She was the daughter of a construction laborer. So anyone who's been to India, I'm born in India, knows that it's not like construction workers in Europe or in USA. She was daughter of bonded labor. She was raped and had a baby. When she came in with cancer. And so I would take her 2-year-old baby to the nursery because she could not take care of her on the bed. And we had to drain her lungs. And every day she would say to me, "Doctor, please, please, can she live till she can draw water on her own, that she can pick a glass of water and drink it, that I don't have to do it, she's only 2. And I would bring her thrice a day to play with her mom. And one day, I mean, she was like, really, there was no hope, I mean, medically speaking. So she comes and I just keep the baby on the thing and the baby's trying to wake her mother up because she cannot distinguish between sleep and death. And that day I just cried in front of all the patients, you know, because there's nothing you can do, nothing I could do. And those are moments of stillness. And yet I love my work. I still serve, but she lives with me. She was 22. And of course, we got the baby. I mean, I made sure baby was adopted and all that stuff we do. But that's that space, you know. And so when people came to me, Aftab, in the UN, consultants from around the world to serve, and they meant well. And one of the cases they said, "So what should we do? There's all this logic." Of course, that's important, the expertise. But do I know how to break my heart open without my own agenda? Without wanting to be famous, without wanting to make more money for money's sake, not that you don't need money to pay your bills. It's the only place is that broken heart, serving in hospice without an agenda.
So So thank you, Monica. So unlearning and brokenheartedness apparently go together.
Mm-hmm.
You also spoke about the head. Hanno spoke about the mind, and perhaps at some point today we'll revisit the right place of the conceptual and perhaps later. But shall we go to Thomas or Indra now?
I'm happy to offer something into this space. So I can't help but recognize something in what Monica was saying in my own life. It was a moment that was very formative to me. And interestingly, I've shared it a few times, and sometimes I worry that if you share an experience too much, it loses its power. But it was a very instructive moment for me, which was when I was 11 years old, my brother died in a car crash. And over that night, when we didn't know whether he was alive or dead, we'd simply had a message that he was in the hospital. I had to struggle. I was begging, you know, through prayer for God to save his life. And when I understood that he had died during the night, I was catapulted into that extreme space of unlearning. And the feeling was of being completely lost, because my sense of, or my understanding of where power is and what my agency is and what the power that I had relied upon until then was, which in my childish way, you know, was God will save, God will answer my prayer. I probably spent the rest of my life unlearning, even until this moment. My big question is still, where does power lie? Where is my agency? And probably more important, where is the agency of every human being? And I loved Hanno's book for exploring this in so many different ways. I'm right into the space where he and I share, which is the big question of political power and what is the role of political power. And that for me is the greatest space of unlearning now. Because for so long we've relied on an idea that the political classes have it in hand, that they are the ones who will, whose responsibility it is to answer the biggest problems, and that they have it in hand between them. They may disagree, but it's their accepted responsibility. In this last 3 or 4 years when I've been working with the alternative, I know that isn't the truth. That the real intelligence lies outside of that space. And how are we going to bridge those spaces between the great knowing of the people and the political structures that are currently leading, but may need to move into a more service kind of relationship with the intelligence of the whole. So that's just my, you know, sort of bring it to us, to some sort of a focus, my unlearning, but also for me, the appreciation of Hanno's book as a space of real exploration of exactly that question.
Thank you, Indra. We'll flag the topic of power and hopefully circle back to it. Yesterday, my son and I were doing some experiments with each other around going from zero-sum power interactions to synergic power, and they were encouraging. Thomas.
Thank you. So I think I want to go in a little bit different direction. Of course, I could talk about the power of opening of the heart, family and life experiences, having children, losing parents. Could also talk about extraordinary events in life, like going with my son to Burning Man or experiencing psychedelics. All of those events has led me to unlearning. But I also want to say that I don't think unlearning needs to be that drastical or even that emotional necessarily. That also some unlearning that we can do can be more cognitive. And one such unlearning that I'm in the process of right now, and I have perhaps been for a few years, is trying to unlearn separation. And I think really separation is something that is taught to us through culture and through school. And I think we could do a lot there in just changing our worldview and changing the way we teach our young people about the interconnected nature of our world. So I'm talking about unlearning separation from nature, realizing that we are not separate from nature, that we are in an integral part of nature. But I'm also talking about our separation from society, that we somehow have this impression that society is something that is happening to us or that we are experiencing and that this is separate from us. Whereas, of course, we are an integral part of society and we are replicating or recreating or creating society anew every day. So ending our cognitive separation from society and realizing that we are part of this wonderful creation process of society. And then finally, of course, separation from other individuals, which I also think is something that we learn already early on in life and that we can unlearn. And just unlearning these things from a cognitive perspective is of course a first step and perhaps also a necessary step for then later really experiencing this interconnectedness in a much more embodied way. Thank you.
So Thomas, separation, the dynamic of separation, one of its expressions is related to our relationship to our conceptual abilities and how we rely on them. And I imagined what Hanno and Monica and perhaps also Indra pointing to some of the ways in which the conceptual becomes the separating dynamic. What is the shift that we can make in how we rely on our conceptual competencies so that they are actually in the service of undoing separation rather than intensifying separation?
Of course, some aspect of this separation is biologically programmed into us because it has survival value. I'm separate from the lion. The lion wants to kill me. That sort of perception has got survival value. So there is something biological to this perspective. But I also think there is something biological to the perspective of interconnectedness. And that is something that our culture, that way of thinking, is a way of that culture is not promoting. And our schooling is not promoting that. So somehow culturally, the perspective of separation is much more reinforced than the perspective of interconnectedness. And I don't think we should completely shift, because we need both perspectives, but we need to hold them at the same time. And to realize, yes, I am a separate individual. And yes, it has value to me to separate things out in the world and name them and separate them and analyze them. But then at the same time, I must remember that we are also interconnected, and that the totality and the ability to see the totality in a holistic view is adding a completely different dimension to reality than the view of separation. And then it's up to us to be able to hold both these perspectives at the same time. And of course, that is a more complex way of viewing the world. But I think that is where we need to go again, because we, of course, humanity has been there, and there has been much more balance between this sort of analytical and holistic way of seeing the world. If you go too much in the other direction and just look at the holistic way, then you might be also missing important information about what is going on in the world. So I think it's a matter of unlearning and learning at the same time.
So I noticed, Thomas, that my listening shifted while you were just speaking, that you did go a different way. You made, for lack of a better descriptor, I'll say you made a conceptual turn. And I'm glad you did. And I followed you there, and I noticed that something has shifted in my listening, which does have a quality of more separation. Not necessarily a bad thing, but I'm just noticing that happening. What's going on with listening here? And how do we give the conceptual its place, and what is the post-conceptual possibilities of relating?
To stay in the spirit of unlearning, I wanted to pick up what you were saying and reflect that for me, one of the largest areas of learning unlearning has been in recognizing what is a public discourse. So when I hear you speaking and I hear or I listen maybe to the political discourse or the social discourse, or I often feel at odds with it. And I ask myself why that is. And this is something maybe that I've been experiencing for not my whole life, actually, but maybe for the last 10, 15 years, more than before. And this is around accepting and acknowledging what is being said, and at the same time, feeling something quite different myself. So when I think about my relational life, or how I experience my daily life, I think much more naturally around connectedness. I think all the time about my family, my community, and also because I've had a life as a Buddhist, I think about the three realms of connectedness, the self, to the community, to the planet. I feel as if I've lived in a world of connectedness, and that with the women around me, maybe many of them are parents or sisters, but also many maybe will be in caring professions. I feel that our connectedness is taken for granted, but it's always there. But what I've learned more recently is that isn't the dominant discourse, that our public space is a public space of disconnectedness. You're absolutely right how you described it. But for me, there's a learning, a new learning about the two existing side by side. One is more private, maybe historically more domestic discourse around connectedness, and the other, the more public space disconnectedness. And just to pick up also on what was said earlier from you, Aftab, about the conceptual, quite often for me, the experience is the public space is quite conceptual, especially in the realm of power. But the private space is more around the communal, and sometimes in public discourse, this is described as grassroots. And so the importance for me has been about how to move from what I call the map to the territory. You know, that movement from the map to the territory, from the knowing to the unknowing, and then being embodied in a space, absolutely describes some relationship between these two things.
If I can follow up here. First of all, for all of those who thought this was interesting, Indra will publish a book as well very soon, The Politics of Waking Up, which is a book I can highly recommend. So check that out. I think it will be out in May as well, right? Yep.
Together with you, Hannu.
Yep. I'm hoping for April, but we're in the same bunch, basically. I find it quite interesting what we're talking about here. And what came to my mind when I listened to you guys speaking was that one of the reasons I wrote my book, and one of the reasons why I do my work in the political sphere, but also in organizations, mostly the private sector, is that we have this tremendous challenge of making concepts which are mostly implicit, explicit, right? To have people consciously acknowledge which concepts guide them and make them, which is the first and most crucial step in the process of unlearning, right? I have to acknowledge what is there before I can unmake it and become someone else or something else. And I believe that this is a very human challenge, quite an existential one, actually, because this is something which can change us potentially at our core. But obviously, it's also the challenge we face as social systems, as societies especially, right? Because many of the concepts that lead us today, that guide us today, make us do things we should not do and make us do things we realize are the wrong things to do. And yet we keep on doing them. And although we notice that, although we acknowledge that there is a gap between, you know, what we should do and what we actually are doing, we keep on doing what we're doing. And why is that? It is because we are not acknowledging what is. We're not acknowledging what is implicitly guiding us. And I think one of the most important things we can do as doers and thinkers today is make the implicit explicit.
Perhaps, Monica, we can get a take from you and then return to Thomas. I circle back to you, Thomas, after that.
Thank you. I just am so inspired by Indra and Hanno and Thomas. And I want to say how I used some of, you know, how I navigated some of the difficult discourses. So I've used a few practical tools for myself. I'm not saying the world needs to use them. The first is I always use interconnectedness with interdependence, because interdependence can be measured and it is part of complexity. And it is what we measure is what we move. So for me, that everyone's bringing up interconnectedness with interdependent complex systems, because we are about systems. That's one. The second is this Thomas and Aftab, you brought up conceptual domain. In my life, I'm very clear that ideology and ideological stances, whether they be political or they be related to business or they be related to religion, I mean, there are ideological spaces, and the Dalai Lama says it very beautifully, the context of how we act and think. So basically for me, I distinguish ideology as a conceptual space from the willingness of a human being to look at my conceptual space based on what Hanno just brought up, who I am, and acknowledging who I am at my deepest core. And let's say at that deepest core, there is our brainstem that wants survival, and as Thomas says, you know, we are separate. And yet there is that space that Rumi says, come and meet me there where there is no each and other. So we hold both end. And to me, this distinction we've used in large-scale strategy between ideology and what the derivatives of that are, and the ability to look at any ideological space and examine it through inquiry, not criticism so much. So that's been a second. But the third for me, most important, has been a commitment on one side to this intrinsic self being made explicit, how I think, who I am, what I do, and to be able to know that and hold it with one hand, and with the other hand, be able to commit to results for humanity, whether that be in the domain of peace. So in that holding space is the emergence of the best of us. And so for me, results, I know we all don't want to commit to results, but how will we change a discourse if we don't say, well, is that the outcome you want? Then is this the discourse we need? And that's how I've operated inside the UN with governments, civil society, and business. Because there's something about an outcome that everyone agrees to. We should have less poverty on the planet. Nobody disagrees with that. Okay, if that's the result you want, and then you want the other results, we should all be thriving, not just surviving. Okay, let's talk about. And then work it towards, are these social narratives maintaining status quo, or are the social narratives transforming what we know? Because to me, you know, look at the elections in the country I'm sitting in right now and Aftab is sitting in, which is the US. Well, whoever we elected in the past, and our politics show that citizens may not always want peace, who may want division. That's why, Thomas, when you said it, you know, it rung such a true bell. What do we need to do? Not put people in political power and citizens as the bridge between them, but the bridge between who I am, which is most probably the word awakening, Indra, that you bring up. It is the awakening of all, the voter and the politician. So that's how I've held those spaces of seeming contradiction. Results, interdependence, and yeah, the difference between ideological stances and worldviews born out of who I am.
Thank you, Monica. Thomas.
I want to build a little bit on what Monica said there about making the implicit self explicit. So I think that in these times of deep shift, in times of transformation, in times of unlearning, we need to go deep into our psychological self, deep into our unconscious, and try to find our personal hidden assumption, our root metaphors, the unknown principles by which we are navigating this world. But just as we need to do that personally, we also need to do that collectively. Mm-hmm. We do not speak so much about that collectively. You refer to that a little bit when you talk about the need to become aware of our ideologies, and perhaps even deeper in sociology, when we go down to our collective unconscious, our collective mm-hmm. root metaphors. Some sociologists talk about our collective imaginary. And we are usually not talking about these very, very deep levels in our society. Sometimes we talk about it on our deep psychological individual levels. But I think it's very important that we become aware of these deep sociological layers, and that we put our collective imaginary on the table and start talking about that. What are the hidden assumptions in our society? What are our root metaphors? What are the filters that we take for granted? And it's probably at that deep level, both individually and collectively, where the necessary unlearning is taking place.
Mm. Yes.
That is so crucial, right? Because there is a gap in public discourse when it comes to politics. including the think tank I work in, we talk a lot about future visions and, you know, where we are going with the transformation we're attempting to get done. But there's really a lack of the introspection you just described, Thomas. You know, what is it that guides us? What is it that makes us collectively not care that billions of others and non-human life suffers existentially because of the lifestyle we choose every day? There is something in us that makes us not care and makes us not see and makes us not feel interdependence. But nothing or separateness, right?
That something is both in us individually,
yes,
but it's also something in us collectively.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely.
And we need to see and address them both.
Right. And when we address them today, what we mostly do is we finger point and we judge and we accuse others, you know, that they are that way. And we say, I am not like this. You are like this. You are the problem. We could see that in the US when, you know, we had this basically a civil war happening between people who supported Trump and those who were against him. But we do not say, okay, this is who we are.
Yes.
Let's acknowledge it. Let's not judge it. Let's just acknowledge it. Let's put it on the table and then let's talk about it and see, you know, what helps us on our way forward and what may hinder us from moving forward. And this is a discursive process which I believe needs a lot of political leadership to happen. And I don't see that at the moment. I don't see that at the moment. And I don't believe this is something which will emerge. I think this is something which we together must consciously design to enable people to be in dialogue on those issues.
Can I offer into that space, which is such a ripe space, Hannah? The relationship between political leadership and society, the broader society, or maybe we could even pin it down to, if we look in your town, you know, where you live, the relationship between the council and the community, you know, wherever the representation of the state lies, and then wherever the representation of the people, we the people, is, there needs to be a dialogue between these two spaces. Because if you look outside of the political discourse or the media narrative that feeds on the political discourse, you will see that these questions are being asked and interrogated and explored voraciously by the people. For decades, you know, the biggest publishing phenomenon has been self-development. You know, people's desire to know more about themselves has been growing and evolving for decades. I would say that social media reflects a lot of that evidence. Now, it's not a controlled space, it's not a well-managed space, it's a dangerous space. But the appetite for self-knowledge is definitely there. And
but Indra, isn't that mainly individual self-knowledge? Isn't that mainly individual self-knowledge?
Not simply. I just wanted to move it slightly to some of the areas of learning that are not in the discourse around self-knowledge that we're having here. So for example, for myself, right? Is there a self? This is a question I'm really asking myself a lot these days. And understanding, first of all, the biological self, the role of emotions, how emotions shape my sense of myself. Secondly, discourse. What is my constructed self? My idea of myself has been constructed by so many things throughout my life that do I know myself at all? How do I get access to that self? And a really good example of that for me was last year with what happened with the George Floyd episode and Black Lives Matter, that I made a huge shift in that time. And the shift was from thinking that there was a problem, which Black Lives Matter was representing and I was observing, shifted to I am the problem, that I'm part of the problem. And I owned it in a different way for the first time. And that was a learning for me. You know, these shifts in self-knowledge are happening in real time. So I'm hesitating to claim that I know myself or that I could identify my true self. I feel there's a lot of unlearning around what that means.
You know, Indra, Oscar Wilde has a wonderful line about this, which is only the superficial know themselves. And a friend of mine retorted by saying, and only the superficial know others. So let me see here. If we keep going down this iceberg of knowing self, we do perhaps at the lowest or the next to the lowest point in the iceberg, come to what's been referred to as the collective imaginary or the collective unconscious imaginal structures and so on, that there is a place where I hesitate to say these words, where we are the same because we are formed by the same substance, whatever this mysterious substance is. And given modernity's individualism and the degree to which we are still moderns, we struggle to even speak about this depth of the iceberg and the way in which the wound of separation goes down all the way down to that. And I'll just invoke a word that's not used much now, and the word is alienation. That there is an old word which points to the separations that distort. Not all separations distort, but it's the separations that distort that embed us in the wound of separation.
But isn't this what makes the inquiry into ourself individually so interesting, right? The more we unlearn ourselves, the more we let go of who we think we are, the deeper we Well, let's say we wander along the tree. First, we have, you know, the twigs, and then we come to the stem, and at some point we may come to the roots. And the further we unmake ourselves, the more we discover what we are part of, because we relate ourselves in a different way. And while we may discover that there is some kind of original source which makes us unique and wonderful, we also discover that this source is fed by something which unites us, not only with other humans, but basically with all life on the planet, right? Maybe even in the universe, I don't know. I haven't gone down, you know, to those roots yet. But it's quite interesting because this is a simultaneous movement. So we unmake ourselves, and by unmaking ourselves, we become part of the whole.
Beautiful, Hanno. I see in chat a message from Ida with a beautiful line. With myself, I can be. With a stranger to myself, I can become. And which reminds me, Hanno, that your book begins with the theme of otherness. I'm also remembering in this moment a line from Rumi where he says, touch me so I can become myself. Shall we make this a shift towards our guests and participants and see what is being evoked for them? And but before we do, let me just see if the panelists would like to make some kind of parenthetical before we shift to our participants.
I think, Aftab, what we are all saying is that knowing who I am is the vital energy for our humanity. I think there's a second question we are all saying, and that is, personal transformation is a necessary but not sufficient condition for social change. There is a little more we need to intentionally do and craft.
So thank you, Monica. So Tom, where did Tom go? He was here a moment. Oh, there he is. Tom, I don't see your hand, but I see you, and I see all the books behind you, and I know how important scholarship's been to you, and I also know that you appreciate post-conceptual development. So I just go to you first to see what's present in your big mind.
Thank you, Aftab. You know, it's 300 years since Hegel, and it's amazing as we articulate the complexity of what he seemed to get a glimpse of. It's going to be complex. Like, I love what you said, Monica, the ideology is a conceptual space. I mean, that's well said. And that's more on the surface level of what we're able to profess. And then you said it, Tomas, the unconscious root metaphors. This is going to be very deep. I mean, it's going to be a couple more hundred years when we're able to operate on those levels of variables that emerge. So I found it very, very rich. I made a ton of notes already. But I was waiting, Aftab, until you brought up the issue of power, interjecting it into this. Who said love without power is anemic? Luther, Martin Luther King. And I think a lot of times we suffer from that because, you know, we meet in these circles, but how much influence do we have out there, as Monica said? So very rich, and I've enjoyed it.
Tom, I'm curious why you said 200 years, and Tomas, I think you maybe were going to respond. But first, Tom, why 200 years?
I just think the complexity of this is huge. There's so much subtle awareness it requires in order to operate in a very nuanced way that I think we're just on the footsteps of it. You know, I'm trained as a psychologist, and, you know, you think Freud's only 100 years, and we weren't even thinking that way. There was philosophical inquiry, but we're just on the infancy of all of this. And it's fun to play on this edge as we try to language the map. We've got a long way to go.
Mm. Yes, could I just comment there? This is a deep shift for humanity. It's a deep shift. And the shift that we are entering in now is at least as deep as the Enlightenment shift. It could be as deep as the Axial Age shift. The Enlightenment shift took a couple of hundred years. The Axial Age shift took perhaps 1,000 years. So it is a long, deep shift. But on the other hand, the world is moving much, much more rapidly now. And the shift that is achievable now between generations is much greater now than it was 100 years ago. I just need to look at my own children who are in their 20s now, and what a huge shift we have now in each generation. And also, we do not have that much time for this shift. The Enlightenment could take a few hundred years, and the axial shift 1,000 years, but we don't have that time. So it's a race against the clock. And I'm pessimistic. This will take generations. But then on the other hand, I also see optimistic signs that things are happening fast.
So
I think I, Aftab, if you don't mind, I think I'd like to say something about to link the question with this idea of power. Because I feel that we've been in a revolution for at least 20 years, a very heady revolution, a very visceral revolution, because ever since the birth of the internet, our relationship to each other has changed profoundly. So if any of us can remember before the internet, how disconnected we were from information, how disconnected we were from each other, how we even were so disconnected from ourselves because we didn't have a public space that we could perform in. All of this has been changing so rapidly over 20 years. You know, I can see the difference between myself as a child and my son and their relationship to the imaginal space is completely other than mine. He has no problem with globalization or the global space. He has no problem with imagining people. He is actively, daily creating imaginaries that he shares with thousands because he has a YouTube channel. So this shift for me was already heralded 20 years ago by Joseph Nye when he talked about the difference between hard power and soft power. And he anticipated, so hard power, you know, is still what politicians trade in. Guns and money. Still now we think of power as mostly hard. But in reality, soft power, which is the power of narrative, the power of storytelling, the power of influence and attraction, a completely different form of power, has been shaping outcomes for our world. Well, all our lives, in fact, but we've only been awake to it over the last 10 years or so. And so I would say that that rapid shift, Tom, has been happening over this past 20 years. And for me, it's how do people embody that and awaken to it? That is the area of learning, unlearning, that I think for me in Hanno's book, I can see very live. It's really acknowledging and acknowledging what we have hidden ourselves from ourselves. That if you really look, it's already present. The question is, are we willing to invest in that thing now, to manage it better and to harvest it, to take us into a different direction? I feel that it comes as fast as making relationships with people on the ground. When I meet somebody I didn't understand for the first time, it opens up a new world for me. It's so fast. Oh, can we invest in that? Can we acknowledge that it's there? Move with it. I think that's also what Greta Thunberg did. Greta Thunberg did just that. Sorry, Hannah.
No, it's all right. But, and also, and I would like to add that that's the reason why I speak so much and work so much on democratic transformation. I think we must build containers that are able to not only cultivate this, but also hold it and make it productive, right? Because now it's scattered. There's a lot of asynchronicity and we need to get better and actually, you know, basically sourcing the potential that's already there and then cultivate it. And that requires new structures and new democratic processes. Which I believe is why these questions are not boring, but really super vital, because this is complementary. You cannot do one without the other. It will be fruitless, right?
Tom, I appreciate the non-Pollyanna-ish perspective of 200 years. And it's clear that your saying that has opened a line of inquiry here. So, And I know that you violated some norms of certain parts of San Diego to even say such a thing. Tom lives in San Diego. So, you know, there was the Renaissance. And so could we, given what's happened between the empowerment of women and the feminine, number one, and number two, the digital revolution. Could it be that those two legs, along with something else, could let us pole vault, you know, to a whole other altitude here in much less time? How long can we wait before some real movement on nuclear disarmament, for example? So many more threads here we're opening up, but Beatrice, you've had your hand up for a while and I don't want to close without hearing from you. You're mute on your
thank level. You. Thank you, everybody. Very interesting, very rich opportunity to be here as an observer with my whole being working in a very accelerated way, trying to pull so many threads, more than what I have here right now in front of me. So I'm thinking, if all that we are seems to be in one or another way, a conditioned way, let's say biologically, we receive from the ancestors, etc., we have that charge of conditioning, then since our conception, we have the conditioning from the outside world, starting with a mother, etc. And we all grew up with that conditioning. As Indra was saying, we have those labels of superimposed of who we are and we accept them. How do we discover who we really are? I have that question. Where in the mix of all those conditionings happens or is downloaded or is created that uniqueness of each one of us, that appreciating absolutely that we all are one, are interdependent, still we have the paradoxes to work with and we are unique. How do we discover that lightning of uniqueness that will point, in my opinion, to our mission, our purpose in life, the baton that we all have a reason to be. And I have the baton only as I am alive, unless I pass the baton to my descendants or to the new generations, though they are not related directly with me. So my point is, coming back again to my question, how do we, each of us, find our uniqueness in this beautiful commonality? Thank you very much.
That was exquisite, Beatrice. Thank you. Because we only have 4 minutes left, Ida and Lisa have had their hand up. If we could get a brief comment or question from you, Ida, and then Lisa, we would still have time for a brief closing statement from the panelists. Ida?
Yeah, I was late signing in technical difficulties, and I got half of the discourse, but it impacted me at a time when I needed to be impacted, because everything that has been said has touched me in a different way. As Beatrice was just saying, I was thinking about uniqueness and similarities, but I was also recalling at this age, and I'm, you know, older now with older children, how important it is for me now to accept my differences and how I am different and how the Black Lives Matter, yes, I am part of the problem, yet that is not my intention. And as Monica said, it is only if I can come to the conclusion of setting certain principles that I will abide by, that I will work with, that I will act upon, can I continue my intention not to be part of the problem and to be something else? So I really do think actions here for me are very important to continue my uniqueness. And the uniqueness is about being different, not being one. And for me, that's very important right now. And as Beatrice was just saying, this desire to pass on the baton, and I think we all teach, we all pass on to the generations what we can. And I realized that I'm mourning this year because I learned my craft in a beautiful way, face to face with people, from people. And I've been teaching what I teach face to face. But for the past year, I only have this online, this technologically bound way to pass on my craft. And I realize I am mourning this. I'm mourning the bodies, the loss of the bodies in the room and that physical contact. And I'm regretting it. It's causing a lot of sadness in me. So you brought me back to that. It's something that makes me angry. I find myself rebelling against the times, but to remember how sad I am actually about it was very replenishing for me. Thank you all.
Thank you, Ida. I'm remembering Wallace Stevens' line, the worst of all things is to not live a physical life. Lisa.
Thank you, everyone. This has been really incredible conversation. Just briefly, I am very inspired by that comment about intergenerational transfer and how do we become more conscious about learning that crosses longer time spans. and think of that as learning. So returning to these themes of power and love and interdependency and making the tacit explicit, I wonder if Monica made the fascinating comment contrasting connection with interdependency, and that interdependency is something that we can measure. And I would love to hear her expand on that. Thank you.
So when I measure, since I work on measurement, I measure three things. So for any domain that I may work in, there is an explicit measure, right? That is like how many people have food or don't have food, or how many people can go to school or to college. So there is something visible that I measure. So that's most probably most of what we see, right? The second measure is what we don't see, like everyone, like Hanno and like Thomas and Indra. There is a space in systems that we don't see, the rules of the game that maintain status quo and power. And how could we measure that? That space requires me to articulate the shift I want and then measure that shift. We usually have so many ideas, and we don't zero in on the first five. And then we think that, you know, if there are 100 ways of doing it, let's work on all the 100. Well, let 100 people work on 100. How do we align that space? So that's a design issue, you know? So to me, systems change requires design, like Buckminster Fuller said. So to respond to your question, I need to be able to articulate as individual and community. Thomas, thank you for bringing up collective. Individual and collectively, I need to be able to articulate the patterns that I need to shift. And I need to know tools of synergy. There are tools and templates that I can use for synergy rather than summation. Summation means 1 + 1 + 1 = 3. Synergy is 1 + 1 + 1, maybe 5,303 or whatever. So I need to learn how to be able to have synergy in the collective spaces that are largely invisible. And there are ways to measure that. And there's a little bit of that in the book I wrote, Radical Transformational Leadership, on the chapter on measurement. And thirdly, the space that we are all exploring, self. And when we began with gross national happiness, we used contentment as the proxy, because that's an immeasurable space. You cannot measure it through classical means. So how do we generate proxies that are culturally specific? That means what matters in India may not matter in the US. You know, how we measure self-determination of women is not the same in every culture. So proxies for the spaces of the digital world as a space for humanity and its good, or the feminist movement and women, as Althad said. So there are three measures we do simultaneously, which I can describe more another time, but thank you for asking.
Monica, would you like to add anything else by way of a closing thought?
Oh, it's everyone's so inspiring. I was disturbed by 200 years, you know. I felt not only will I be deaded, but at least 20 generations behind me will get deaded. And so for me, and you're so right, God, that urgency that we need. Oh, no, I'm in a great space. This inquiry that Beatrice, you're asking us to ask a question that's not just one lifetime, that's several lifetimes. Knowing who I am. Like, I love Indra's work. Yeah, yeah, yeah. It's like if you believe in several lifetimes, otherwise this one will do. I don't have an answer. We all explore it differently. We must explore it differently, depending on our training, our inclination. And so you actually concluded our whole panel discussion, Beatrice, by that one question. Do I live in the image of myself, as the Buddha often said, or in Vipassana? Do I want to uphold that image, or am I willing to do the deep dive? And yeah, you are the one who concluded our panel discussion, actually.
Thank you, Monica. And Hanno, what a provocation and disruption your book is going to be. Closing thought?
Maybe just as one, I think this is something to underline what has been in this space already. So yes, we have this journey of, discovering our core and what makes us unique. It's like peeling an onion. You will basically never get to the end, but it's really worthwhile. But this becomes meaningful only if we connect this journey, this exploration, this unbecoming to a higher purpose.
Yes.
And to a higher, thing we're trying to feed into by transforming ourselves. So this letting go of myself is never an end itself. It's really a service we do to something which is higher than us.
Thank you, Hanno. Thomas, we created a little world here today. Just so people know, Thomas's recent book, not so recent now, a couple of years, is entitled The World We Create. Closing thoughts, Thomas?
Right, I could close on that note and saying that we shouldn't forget that we are constantly creating this world that we live in, that individual transformation is hard. Collective transformation might be even harder, but we shouldn't forget that as individuals we are carrying a biological inheritance that is millions of years old, whereas when it comes to our society, our collective imaginary, that is just a recent human makeup. So it shouldn't be that difficult to transform our collective imaginary.
Indra, thank you, Thomas. Indra?
So I thank you for this discussion. It's been so rewarding. And I sort of want to just draw attention to this very moment that we're in, and what that feels like. And then maybe ask ourselves, where can I bring this moment somewhere else? I wanted to pick up Hanno's call for the need for containers. I feel that we can do all the work that we need to do within a small community of people, especially if that community of people is full of people we don't know and perhaps would never normally meet. When you bring this kind of conversation in those kinds of spaces, my experience is that your belief in the possibility of things changing gets great energy. Through making relationship where there wasn't any before in these kinds of spaces, which have so accelerated during COVID, it generates belief, believe me. you believe it's possible. So that's my experience today, and it's also my experience more and more in the places that I think that we can do this. So thank you very much. I've enjoyed it.
Thank you, Indra. By way of closing, I'll offer 4 lines from a poet that some of you will know, perhaps many, Spanish poet Juan Ramon Jimenez, won the Nobel Prize in 1956. This is translated by Robert Bly. I have a feeling that my boat has struck down there in the depths against a great thing. And nothing, nothing happens, nothing. Silence, waves, nothing happens, or has everything happened? And we are standing now quietly in the new life. Thank you, everyone, for bringing as much of yourself as you did today. And special thanks to the panelists and Hanum. And perhaps we will meet at another crossroads. And if we do, we'll recognize each other. Goodbye for now.
Thanks for joining us. Integral Voices is produced by the Center for Transformative Learning at Meridian University. All episodes are available at meridianuniversity.edu/integralvoices. For more information about Meridian, including upcoming public courses, other podcasts, and information sessions, visit meridianuniversity.edu. See you next time.